Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about building science, energy efficiency, and green remodeling at home. Here in the studio with me is John Viner, building services and consultant in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. John, pleasure to see you today.
Pleasure to see you, Larry. Jim.
And also Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, a full-service residential remodeling company. And Chad, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
Congratulations on your election to the Monona City Council.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to serve the public, and I'm having a good time so far.
Good. If people have questions about home renovation and repair issues that they're facing or looking at or thinking about, all you have to do to get an answer is to give us a call in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Chad, I noticed an article in the Wall Street Journal that dealt with the costs of green remodeling and of green building. And in there, it says that an Indianapolis research firm surveyed builders for Building Products magazine, and it found that the greatest number of builders estimated about a 10 to 19% cost increase when choosing green remodeling. What do you think about that?
Well, That's probably a realistic number. You know, there are a lot of things that have to factor into the equation. And certainly when you do things more sustainably, you're not necessarily clear-cutting forest. In fact, you're definitely not clear-cutting forest. And you're using materials that have been more carefully produced. So there's going to be a little added cost to that. The one thing that is not often factored into the equation that I always try to point out to homeowners is that, for example, when you are building a better home that's more energy efficient and is going to last a longer time, it's cheaper to heat and cool that home, and it's cheaper to maintain the home. And so your living expenses in the home will, in fact, be less, even though your mortgage might be a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
There's a particular study that came out in end of 2007 looking at the Energy Star program for new home construction. And it found that on average, it adds about $10,000 to the typical $250,000 new home. So that's actually about a 5% increase mm-hmm. to meet Energy Star ratings. But that saves you twice as much every month in energy savings on average than the added cost on the mortgage. It adds $50 to your mortgage, and it saves you about $100 on your energy bill. So that's a good example of how a little bit of an investment when you're building can actually pay back and then some when you're living in the home. I think green products have a similar payback with improved quality of the air in the home, which leads to healthier occupants.
Mm-hmm.
It saves on your energy bill. And again, hopefully creates a more durable home.
Anything to add to that, John?
Yeah, I speak with a lot of homeowners throughout the year that are doing everything from small renovations, improvements, to large renovations. And many of them are taking that path, but I haven't heard anybody say it's cost less or equal to a standard. They are making conscious decisions to upgrade the mechanical systems. Ideally, as Chad has been speaking to, upgrading energy efficiency, insulating and air tightness as a priority, which is reducing durability costs down the road and energy costs down the road. That's one aspect of green. If somebody takes the green initiative towards environmental and low VOC paints, for et cetera, and we can go that direction, and that's fine, but all that should be coupled with energy efficiency, and then we get those great benefits that Chad's been talking with.
John Viner and Chad Spate are our guests. The lines are filling, and let's go to the phones, take some calls. We'll start with Jim in Madison. Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I have a 30-year-old ranch house that I'm remodeling, and I wanted to put tile floor in the dining room and kitchen, but where the dining room meets the kitchen, there's a big tilt. If I put a straight edge on it, I get about an inch tilt from the end of the floor to the where it
where it
divides
meets
the kitchen and the dining room. Do I just forget about that, or how do I fix that, or that's what I'm looking at. How do I fix that big tilt?
So what are the materials that are down on the floor right now in the two rooms?
I have the subfloor, which is a 3/4-inch plywood, and then I think there's Luan, and then there's two vinyl floors, on one on top of each other.
Okay, well, the first, and the vinyl is in the kitchen probably, but not in the dining room?
The kitchen and the dining room, they adjoin each other.
Okay, but there's still a pretty severe change of elevation at the threshold.
Right, yeah, okay. Like a ridge.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you've got a couple of options. I mean, the one thing that I want to say is, should you decide to remove any material from your home, you do need to be careful and have that material tested for potential asbestos content, because you could have hazardous material in the flooring. It would be fairly common to find asbestos in an old vinyl floor from about 30 years ago. But one option might be to do that removal should you find that you could safely remove material in one room and leave it in another and thus help level out the surface. You could add material in the other room, though I wouldn't generally recommend adding an inch. And then the other thing would be simply to try to find a way to lessen that that variation with a threshold piece that you know, might span the entire width of the door jamb or the opening between the two rooms. Just have a slight bevel to it. I mean, there are a variety of things that you might do to soften that, what sounds like an extreme variation.
Okay. Yeah, a tennis ball will roll down the floor. If I just set it on the edge, it'll roll all the way down the floor. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like there's some settling that's taken place, and generally you have to be very careful if you try to correct for that, though it could be that there's some structural issues that need attention in your home, and that perhaps you should have a qualified engineer or builder look at that and see if there might be something else going on that at least at the point where there's the extreme change in elevation, there might be some additional bracing called for down below. I generally don't recommend moving around a house a lot once it has settled. There are exceptions to every rule, but generally you can cause more damage by trying to re-level a home than simply to go with it and make the best of it once you've stabilized it. So
okay.
There are a couple of things that might help improve
right.
your situation.
I got one more question. What's the best time of year to buy a new furnace?
Best time of year? Usually the summertime, I guess we got air conditioning load and heating contractors. We're looking for a slower season, maybe just to get a better, quicker install. They're going to take more time with you. So as we go into the fall, people are starting to get busy as the heating season ramps up. Springtime, there isn't much heating, there isn't much cooling. Contractors have more time. Maybe they'll be able to give you a little more attention.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
So this sounds like a pretty good time of the year to be looking at heating. A furnace, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. They're starting to pay more attention to air conditioners. They're mm-hmm. getting more calls, but maybe it hasn't peaked at this point.
Jim, thank you very much for your call. Again, our number in Madison is 263-1890 or toll-free 800-642-1234 as we talk with John Viner and Chad Spate about home renovation issues. And let's go next to Mike in Waukesha. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I've got I did a basement remodel project. I've got a ranch home. It's probably about 30 years old, block walls in the basement. We finished off the basement, had a remodeling contractor come in. They did a real good job. They put in a couple of 4 or 5 foot egress windows, and come spring, about 5 feet away in the corner where the sump crock is, we had some water coming in. I thought it was grading issues, took care of that. Took care of the water pretty much, but there's still a very slow leak that seems like it's coming right from the corner in the floor. And whether it rains a lot or it doesn't rain hardly at all, it's just a steady you know, got to change the towel out every 2 days.
So that's near the sump pit then. And is that filling up with water and you're seeing that level rise and lower, or is that...
Well, the sump crock is working fine. It's discharging the water, but this is coming in actually on top of the concrete slab. And the contractor is willing to work with us, but, you know, we're trying to figure out how, you know, if it was disturbed, maybe they hit the wall when they were, you know, putting in the egress windows, but it is like 6 or 8 feet away. But I'm wondering if there's maybe an interior fix where it could be tuck pointed and maybe that would take care of it, or what your recommendation would be, you know, besides digging down on the outside.
So this isn't necessarily related to rain. It comes in regardless if it's pouring outside or not.
Right. It doesn't change the flow at all. It
doesn't change the flow. We just got water table.
You know, I have a feeling that this might be an unfortunate correlation between the remodel and the fact that we just had about 100 inches of snow. I'm not sure if you actually had as much snow in Waukesha this winter as we had here in Madison, but we had a record winter for snow, and there have been many, many thousands of homeowners in the Madison area who have seen basically groundwater infiltration into basements. The hydrostatic pressure is so great that even sometimes with the fully functional sump and drain tile, water is finding a way to bubble up into basements, and it's caused quite a lot of damage in our area. It could be that that's part of what's going on. Having said that, it's also likely that the drain tile that was put in with your 30-year-old home could have been silted over at this point, and in some areas really isn't doing the job. And so you might consider having some things done to scope into the drain tile from your sump pit, since the leak is actually within about 5 feet of the sump. You could have a company come in who does some scoping and see how badly silted is that drain tile. You know, there's some companies that will both clean out the tile and scope it. Someone like a Roto-Rooter type company, and they can perhaps improve the situation without having to dig or tear up the slab in your basement. If that doesn't fix the problem, I will say that it's always best to go to the outside, as John suggested, to keep the water from coming in. But then, depending on how you finish the interior, putting in some sort of an interior drain tile to connect the window well to the sump is another potential way to go that, again, depending on how things have been finished, might be easier.
Yeah, it's pretty well all finished off now, except for that little area we built, like a TV stand on top of where the sump crack is.
Okay.
Now, would that be concrete drain tile, do you suppose, down there?
Well, typically there will be a corrugated plastic pipe.
Even 30 years ago?
Well, that's a good point. 30 years ago, we're not often digging up a home. It could be that there's very little in the way of a actual pipe from 30 years ago. John, do you...
Yeah, I guess I'm not seeing it 30 years ago, so maybe there's nothing there on the outside.
It could just be that there is a sump pit.
Do you think it would be a bad idea to try some kind of a patch on the surface then?
On the outside?
Maybe if it's leaking at the crack between the slab and the block wall, to try to either caulk that in with an industrial caulk or something?
Well, block walls can be very problematic for foundations, that's for sure. And in fact, what will sometimes happen, and it could be what has happened with you, is that the block wall will actually fill up with water and slowly seep out. Because often there are those hollow cavities in it. Depending on how the contractor installed it, if they didn't fill those up, then there might in fact be water collecting in the cavities, and that could be a long-term problem for you in your finished basement. The other thing that I'll just point out is, and this is a different take on what I mentioned earlier with respect to the weather, the other thing to keep in mind here is that when you finish a basement that was not previously finished, you change the the physical qualities of the way heat and air move around with respect to that foundation wall. And so it's really, you know, the laws of physics and building science can kind of take over, and some unintended consequences can result because now we've isolated that block wall and we've actually made it colder on the interior surface. And we may be seeing more condensation than would have happened in the past. It'll change the way vapor passes through that wall. So there are some issues that can arise depending on how the contractor finished the space. And I'll just kind of close by saying that basements are very tricky. And, you know, you can do some small improvements in a basement and actually have some pretty major impacts on the way the house behaves. And sometimes those are not welcome to the homeowner.
No easy way to start on this.
Doesn't appear to be. But good luck to you, Mike.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. We're talking with Chad Spate and John Viner about home renovation and repair issues right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller, who is enjoying life for a couple of days down in Florida, going to Disney World. So I'm sitting in for him and glad that you're along with us. I'm Jim Packard, along with John Viner and Chad Spate. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890 or toll free at 800-642-1234. Nancy is next in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. I have an older house. In fact, it was originally a log cabin up in Ironwood, Michigan, out in the Ironwood Township. And my question is, like everybody else, I'm trying to get the energy consumption down. And we're thinking about blowing in some insulation into the attic. It has a regular attic with floorboards, pulling them up. And there's already something in there from years ago. Somebody said vermiculite. I don't know if that's what it is. But I'm just wondering, does that all have to be pulled out first before we blow in new insulation, or do you just leave it in and blow right on top of it?
Generally, we're just leaving that in there and blowing over the top of that. Asbestos can be tested, the vermiculite can be tested for asbestos. There are some rules and guidelines as we work with that material. Generally, covering that up, the little we can disturb that as possible, the best. If we can, not all vermiculite has asbestos, and again, we can get that tested. And if we cover that up and we can do it effectively, then we're just going to leave it there and not worry about pulling it out.
Okay, great. That was my question. Is there anything else you'd recommend as far as in an attic, any other type of thing besides blowing in insulation in an attic that you really want to walk around in?
Yeah, so you're going to leave the floorboards up there and you use it as storage?
Right, right.
Yeah, so then you have maybe a 2x6 ceiling joist there or so. So
right.
You're going to get, you know, an R value of 19 at the best, 18 or 19 to 21. Ideally, we're downsizing that storage space and insulating that on top of that floor to maximize efficiency if we're willing to give up some of that.
Right. You mean like blue board type thing?
Blue board laying on top of the floor can be a functional as long as we've got that cavity nice and tight, full with insulation. Mm-hmm. But I'm taking it a step further and building a 2-foot dam around, partitioning storage area from non-storage up there so that we can, you know, where it's out at the eaves or there's low clearances, you're never going back there to get the boxes where it's too difficult. Let's get as much insulation then on top of the floor system after we've filled the cavities.
That is a good idea because we do have ice dam problem too.
Yeah, so it's identifying the air, you know, the attic preparation before you insulate any attic is identify where the holes are. You air seal the holes, different than insulating. Then you ensure you got adequate venting in that attic space. Again, this is all attic preparation to insulate. Air sealing, attic venting, and then when we're comfortable with all that, then we insulate.
Okay, and if there is asbestos in the vermiculite, you can still just go right over it. And it encapsulates it pretty much?
It doesn't encapsulate it. We can cover that up. Ideally, I'm going to refer to the insulating contractor to follow the rules and regulations when it comes to that vermiculite if it's tested for asbestos. We'll leave it to the professionals there.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Okay, Nancy, thank you. Good luck to you and your project. And on to Jane in Oconomowoc. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question has to do with linoleum flooring. I live in a 1950s ranch, and the original flooring is linoleum squares. And it's really been long-lasting, and it's worked well, except that the pattern is now old-fashioned, and I want to redo the floors. And wherever I look for linoleum flooring, they don't have it or they've never heard of it until finally this morning I had a local person who sells flooring Google it, and she finally realized what it was. And she looked in the commercial department and was able to find some small samples of linoleum flooring. And my question is that a viable replacement for the tiles that are on there now that have to be replaced? Or should I be looking more at laminates and vinyl flooring? I'm looking more for green materials in remodeling.
Yes. Well, I mean, definitely linoleum is a greener material, but it does have a higher upkeep. You know, a traditional linoleum floor, you're going to want to wax it.
Okay.
If you don't mind having a little bit higher maintenance surface, then it's a great way to go. And I know in the Madison market, there are a couple of local companies that are doing business, you know, in residential remodels with linoleum.
Mm-hmm.
It has become popular again. I think you're probably better off. I was going to say you might be better off replacing the whole floor, that you might not be able to very easily do a repair job to a 1950s floor. But, I mean, that, and I'm not real clear if you were perhaps asking if you could do that, but obviously maintaining what you have would be the greenest thing to do.
Uh-huh. Except that the pattern is not very pretty, and mm-hmm. there are a few squares that are showing its age.
Okay, sure. So I think you should be able to find someone in Oconomowoc that can help you with a linoleum product. And I would encourage you to do the research on some of the additional care that will require. But I think that you'll find that that's a great way to go.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you today, Jane. And let's go on to Tom in Windsor next. Hi, Tom. What's on your mind?
Good morning, gentlemen. Just like that of the first caller, I think it was the first caller, second caller, I got water in my basement this year twice. We've been in the house 2.5 years. It's a 1965 ranch. A number of houses in the neighborhood have also, and I believe it's from the snow melt this year, the amount of snow we have. My next-door neighbor's lived there 11 years, never had it in his basement before. But we're thinking about putting some drain tile on the side of the house where it's coming in. I didn't get huge gushes at the worst the first time. I'm guessing a little over 100 gallons. And, of course, it picked the wall right where there's a finished room, the only finished room in the basement. Is drain tile a good idea? And if so, should we also put some waterproofing on the outside wall of the basement? And also, should we put some insulation of some sort if we dig it up?
Yes, well, if you are going to dig up the outside, and certainly the best way to waterproof a home is starting on the outside, on the exterior where the source is, you could do quite a thorough improvement by excavating, waterproofing the foundation right down to the footing, installing a drain tile with rock at the base, and then insulating the wall and backfilling over that. There are a number of details that are very important. For example, before the hole is backfilled, you need to make sure that the rock and drain tile have been properly protected with a landscaping fabric, which allows the water to flow through but helps to reduce the amount of silt and other contaminants getting into that system to prevent it from properly draining. And then Certainly, I would recommend 2 inches of blueboard foam on the exterior, which is what a standard best practice would call for to insulate your home. So you'll be getting a lot of added improvement to your home if you're able to do all of those things, and provided the landscaping around your house and the overhangs will allow that to be done without too much damage, that would be the best way to go. If you're not able to easily dig up on the outside, there are some ways to do it on the interior. And that in older homes, that's often what ends up happening.
Okay. Is that just putting waterproofing on the inside walls mostly, and then they maybe digging up around the outside wall and putting in some drainage there?
Well, yes to both of those. Generally, putting in a sump system with a perimeter drain tile, which is a trench is dug just inside of the footing in the basement. And the drain tile is installed with gravel, and then the cement is patched. And that's connected to a new sump pump. And there are a couple of things to keep in mind. Radon is very common in Wisconsin, particularly in southern Wisconsin. And so I'm going to recommend that if you have any sort of unsealed sump pits in your basement, it's important to seal those up. And even better, it's good to have a plug-in radon detector to make sure that radon is not prevalent in your home environment. Because if it is, and you do have a sump system, radon remediation can be installed in a fairly cost-effective manner. And then to answer the question about painting the inside, it is commonly done to try to seal up cracks and use a hydraulic cement patch to patch the inside of a foundation wall. The only thing I'll say, you know, if you think of that foundation wall as a dam that's holding back all that water pressure on the exterior, you know, patching that crack on the inside is definitely the final defense against water getting in. And so, as we discussed originally, doing it on the outside is the best way. But if that is cost prohibitive, or you have a considerable investment in landscaping out there that you don't want to destroy, you can apply some cement-based paints that are designed to provide some protection against water infiltration.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, Tom. Good luck to you. Thanks very much. And the number for you to get a question or comment in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. As we talk with Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner of Building Services and consultant in Mount Horb. Let's go next to Tom in Madison. And, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We live in a split-level home. It's about 13 years old, and we have just a terrible problem with moisture in the home. When we bought the home, I didn't give it much thought. The folks that owned it had a couple of dehumidifiers in the basement. Now that we've been living in the house, I kind of understand why. But so what happens is I'm going to have to replace one of the windows because it is rotted out. And I'm fearing that I'm going to have to replace others as well. Ice builds up on the interior of the windows during the wintertime because there's so much moisture in the house. And I get mold growing as well. So I'm not sure, you know, other than getting dehumidifiers, if there's anything else that I can do to correct that problem.
So we have to find that source of moisture, right? Hey, you have any clues? You've been thinking about it for a while. Where's that moisture coming from? Any gut feelings?
You know, I mean, we have two bathrooms, and we both, you know, use our own bathroom and create a lot of steam from showers. Mm-hmm. It's a small house. It's only about 1,300 square foot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just on the main level, it's just a kitchen and a living room, and then there's a master bedroom upstairs and a bedroom down. So
the basement stay dry?
The basement stays dry.
Okay. And then we're looking at, you know, obviously the plants and pets and the cooking
right.
and all that, and having appropriate ventilation at those sources where we're producing the moisture. That's kitchen exhaust fans and bathroom exhaust fans, and having those available and operating. Those are the first steps of any time we're trying to mitigate a moisture problem, and window condensation is taking care of the moisture where we produce it.
Right.
If we're doing that adequately, maybe we do have a tight home and we need additional ventilation on a more regular basis than just when we're producing it. So first we have to identify the sources. If you're bringing in 100 perennials to winter inside the house, those do produce moisture. Or if you have a crawl space with a dirt floor, that puts in a lot of moisture into the house. Or if you have a spa, a hot tub, all those things that we may not think are a big deal are a big deal, especially if we have a home that's relatively airtight, which is often a goal in energy efficiency, but we don't want to do it to aggravate this problem. So it's the analysis, the in-field analysis, from Home Performance with Energy Star Consultant, which are scattered throughout the state, is going to get there on site to do the analysis and really pinpoint if moisture sources are excessive, or we have a tight building, or insulation is lacking, or the windows are leaky, creating the cold glass surfaces on, depending on their installation.
Right.
I don't have any bullet thing that's going to fix your problem over the radio and the airwaves here, but
right.
it's giving you some ideas of first looking at sources, reducing them, removing the moisture as we produce it, greater ventilation within the home if need be. We don't want to go there necessarily right away as to increase
right.
ventilation, but that may be an additional step.
When we bought the house, as part of the purchase, we asked that there be a home inspection. Nothing was identified during that inspection, but...
what time of the year did you have the inspection done?
It was November.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there should have been moisture present on the window, for instance.
We didn't notice that at the time, but again, as I mentioned, they had two dehumidifiers, and they were running in the basement.
Yeah.
So that may have been taking care of the problem. So if I wanted to have somebody, help us identify what the problem is, who would you suggest?
So you would go to focusonenergy.com. That's a Focus on Energy is a statewide initiative, and they have very qualified individuals throughout the state that can come and take a look at the situation. So
okay.
focusonenergy.com, then find the residential tab, and there'll be a nice spot where you can search for the consultants in your area by county. So very handy.
Okay, focusonenergy.com.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your help.
All right. Thanks very much. One suggestion I heard that makes a lot of sense in this situation is to have a bathroom fan on a timer so that it runs for 30 minutes, let's say, once you leave the shower. Because most people will finish up in a couple of minutes and they'll turn the fan off, turn the light off, and walk out, and all that moisture is still there.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a variety of controls, and the extra dollar or so a month for letting that fan run longer is certainly well worth it from a durability standpoint of that structure. We want it to last long.
Let me say, in his case, he's got about a 1,300-square-foot home, and somebody like yourself comes out. Typically, what will a home inspection run them?
It might run anywhere from $350 to $500 is a good price range, but you're going to get the problem solved,
mm-hmm.
As well as a nice detailed report outlining what needs to be completed just to move the whole structure along. We don't want to change one thing and have negative consequences to others, so it's a real thorough whole house analysis, laying out all the options for you.
All right. John?
I was going to add that one thing that's really important is to make sure that those fans are actually venting to the outside of the structure.
Yeah.
We'll find a lot of times that the ductwork is just haphazardly placed in the attic and the moisture is being pumped into that attic. and it can cause additional problems up there, or it could be obstructed in some way so that air is actually not flowing through the fan. It's making lots of noise, but it's not doing anything.
Yeah, so, and that's a step the consultant will take, is to actually measure the flow through the fan. This measurement and this testing is very important when it comes to understanding the building structure, whether we want to call it improving energy efficiency or going green. We just need some documentation that these things are working according to manufacturer's specs. Installers typically don't do that.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Daniel next in Fox Lake. Daniel, what can we do for you this morning?
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a quick question about insulating a basement floor and walls. What I'm looking to do is I want to put like half or three-quarter inch of styrofoam on the floor and then go over that with like a 3/4 inch tongue and groove board and then be able to carpet over that pad and carpet. There's not really any moisture present in the floor. I'm just wondering, can I put that styrofoam right on the floor, or should I put like that plastic beaded, comes on a roll that you put down? Should I put that down to give a little air space under there?
I think from a best practice standpoint, that dimpled product is a nice product to just provide an airspace there if we ever do get a little water underneath that foam board. So I think it's a good way to go. It hasn't always been necessary. I've certainly seen successful products with that foam sheathing just right on the concrete, as long as we've lived in the home several years and we know there's not a water issue and we maintain the gutters, because maybe there isn't a water problem until the gutters are plugged, and then there's issues arise. As we insulate that concrete floor and the walls can be completed in a similar fashion. Usually we're not using the dimpled product on the walls, simply only the floor. But as we insulate that floor and insulate that wall, we do make those concrete surfaces colder, which can aggravate condensation if home humidity reaches those surfaces. That's why we want to make that foam board and all the seams and edges airtight. So that's taking extra time and care to not only insulate with the foam board, but now air seal that foam board. Insulating and air sealing there has to go hand in hand.
Okay. For the walls, I was looking at putting like a 3/4 inch, gluing a 3/4 inch styrofoam on the wall, the block wall. And then I was going to put up a 3.5 inch stud wall all the way around the exterior perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And then put like 3.5 inch craft face insulation between the studs on that.
Well, what I would recommend is maybe putting your money into a thicker foam board. I would use a 2-inch foam board if you're wanting to do this project yourself, it sounds like. You know, you can buy that 4x8 sheet of 2-inch foam board. You can install that up against the wall, and then you can actually install a stud wall that's not as thick. You could either turn your studs on the side and attach them to the wall, or possibly rip a 2x6 in half and end up with kind of a 2x3 wall. So that gives you enough room for your wiring. But I would put the money into the foam product and seal it well, as John said, and then perhaps leave those cavities open. It doesn't hurt to put the additional insulation in the stud cavity. But as a practical matter, unless each one of those cavities is sealed on the inside, on the backside and the front side, so that air is not moving around freely in those cavities, having that batting there really isn't going to do much from a performance perspective. Because the batting has to essentially prevent airflow in order to be an insulator. If air is flowing around the batting, it really isn't doing what it's advertised to do. And
if I went to the 2-inch styrofoam on the wall and then put the studs flat, give me 1.5 inches, as I know they make the narrower electrical boxes and whatnot.
Right.
If I put those flat, would you advise putting another inch and a half between each one of the studs to get the R value up for? Because we want to make it a living, you know, like a living room, a TV room, that kind of thing. We want to make sure it's warm enough down there to.
Well, if you have the R10, which is the 2 inches of blue board on those basement walls, I think you're going to be plenty comfortable. Of course, it never hurts to have additional R value, additional isolation of the environment to, you know, retain the heat or the air conditioning, whatever it may be. But I think anything over the R10 really isn't going to give you much payback or noticeable comfort.
Yeah, with the wiring and things that have to be run in that inch and a half space, it might be, let's leave it convenient for the wiring, and then the foam board is going to have to be pieced in there. There's going to be more seams. I'm comfortable with the R10.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys' help. Thank you.
Daniel, thank you very much for your call. We're talking with Chad Spate and John Viner today about home renovation and repair issues here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mailer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Williams is our on-air producer today. Thanks very much for joining in as we talk about home renovation and repair issues. John Viner, a building services and consultant in Mount Horeb. Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, our guest today. Let me ask you, John, about tankless water heaters. What are the advantages and drawbacks, if there are any, to tankless water heaters?
The tankless water heater has been becoming more popular, and many of my customers have been turning to them more and more. There are greater efficiencies in the combustion and the fuel process, utilization of the fuel, so we do get greater efficiency of turning more of that heat content of the fuel into the hot water.
Okay.
We also then, of course, minimize or eliminate the losses of a tank-type water heater where we're keeping that 40, 50 gallons of water warm even though we're not using it. So there is certainly, I've seen 10 to 30% increase in savings in performance of a tankless water heater. The other advantage, often a standard tank-type water heater that vents into a chimney, allows warm air, rises, should vent out of the house appropriately. We do find that those units, as we increase the efficiency of the building, just aren't always drafting effectively. So once we go in and do a thorough analysis of the building and we identify some safety issues, that's a nice way to go as we change out that water heater. We make the building more energy efficient. Tighter is the key word here. As we make the building tighter, some of the standard water heaters aren't functioning adequately. Some of the things we need to look for on that tankless water heater is that often we need a water softener to have that unit run long, have a long life. We have to ensure we have adequate gas pipe size. So there's some key components before we install that any installer is going to look at that to do a good job. A disadvantage maybe with an on-demand tankless water heater is when we purchase that, we should look for some that are going to kick on. When we turn the tap water on, water flows through that at a certain flow rate, and some will kick on at various lower or higher flow rates. So if we're, let's say I'm doing dishes and I leave the water trickle out the tap to do some rinsing when I'm at the kitchen sink, that may not be a high enough flow rate to rinse my pipe. So I might have to adjust my lifestyle and do my dishes different, right? Not a big deal. We can manage that.
Of course, we've got the low flow, low use, low water use dishwasher.
Right. So, I haven't heard any concerns there, Jim, but that's a good point. I'm getting great feedback from the homeowners that have it. Every time I see one, I really quiz that homeowner because I want to understand on how well it's functioning for them. And I get very little negative feedback and mostly positive.
Typical price for a tankless water heater install?
Yeah, it's going about twice as much of a standard water heater.
But the payback is going to come in...
The payback, I don't have those years in front of me if we are talking simple payback, but if I can do some mental gymnastics here with math, if we're spending an extra $800 or $1,000, and we're getting 30% energy efficiency or greater savings out of that, I still think we're probably over a 10-year payback on that on-demand water heater. There is some resistance from, I know some plumbers like them, will install them. I'm sure another negative or disadvantage is there's going to be some more maintenance with them, and plumbers will let you know that when you go to purchase some. So they maybe don't install them or have had more repairs. I imagine that that's the case. But they are becoming better and better equipped, and I think they're ready for the market and are going to last a long time.
Chad?
Yeah, another thing is that the tankless will typically last twice as long as a traditional tank heater system. A traditional tank is supposed to last about 10 years. The tankless is designed to last 20 years. And of course, many of these units will last longer than what they are billed as lasting. But that's a big thing to consider, because I mean, basically you're likely to buy two of the traditional tank heaters in the time that you will have enjoyed that tankless system that will be saving you money
as you go along,
as you use it
month after month.
Right.
All right, let's go to the phones again. And again, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. Mike is next in Oshkosh. Hi Mike, what can we do for you today?
Hi, thanks for the show, for putting me on.
Sure.
I'm caretaking for an older schoolhouse. It's been totally renovated, and it's a block building with stucco on the outside. I'm getting water coming in around the windows, and around the windows it has red brick with regular mortar, and the bricks seem a little soft. It doesn't appear like anything is coming away from the stucco is not coming away from the mortar or the blocks or anything. I'm just curious what I could, I'm assuming it's probably coming in the bricks and the mortar. Is there like a sealer or is there something else that I could do to take care of this?
Well, there could be a number of things contributing to that. How tall is the building, and where are the windows in relation to the ground and the roof?
The building is, it's got to be at least 30 feet tall. And it seems to be coming in, there's windows in the upstairs, and there's also windows in the downstairs that they're coming in.
Okay.
And there's awnings around the windows also, so it's not...
not directly falling on the sills themselves.
Yeah.
Huh?
Okay.
And there's an overhang of, I would say, about a foot and a half or two around the whole building also.
Okay. Well, with, you know, water problems can sometimes be tricky, because while it may appear that the source of the problem is right there at the window, the other thing to keep in mind is that the window is the hole in the wall. And so if water were, say, getting in up at the roof level or anywhere above on that wall system, it's going to make itself known to the occupant at the window because there's a hole in the wall there. So whereas water might be getting behind that stucco and traveling down the block in that space that often is there, there's some, you know, there's a mesh, and there's often space for water to travel behind the stucco, but on top of the block, and it then hits the flashing, or maybe there isn't proper flashing at the window, and then it's getting into that window opening. That's one possible explanation. I asked about the grade, because we can also sometimes see actually wicking of moisture up from the ground causing considerable damage in some structures where there might be an underground spring or some other source, a really poor grading, a lot of moisture hitting that building. The block is always saturated, and there again, you've got a hole in the wall with wood. That wood is going to soak up and rot that with the moisture, whereas the block and the stucco will last a long time. So there are a variety of potential explanations. It's probably something a contractor is going to need to look at to assess, probably a mason.
Okay.
That's a good idea to have a mason take a look at it, because they'll be able to identify what isn't wrong with it as well as what's right with it.
Right.
Okay.
All right, Mike, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. And we'll get to Joan, Dave, and Jerry after we take a look at the latest news. Our guests talk about home renovation and repair issues are John Viner, a building services and consultant of Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. He is an Energy Star consultant, among other things. Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, full-service residential remodeling company specializing in sustainable design and historic renovations. I'm Jim Packard. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller as we talk about home renovation and repair issues. Chad Spate is owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. And Chad, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
And John Viner of Building Services and Consultant in Mount Horeb. John, pleasure to see you once again.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
And you wanted to let people know that you're going to be making an appearance at the Energy Fair at Custer, Wisconsin, which runs June 20th through the 22nd, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Will you have a booth up there, or will you be?
I may participate and help out on the Focus on Energy booth. I'm not going to have a booth set up there myself, but just wanted to put a little plug in for that world-famous Midwest Renewable Energy Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up in mid-June. Excellent spot to learn all about renewable energy sources, sustainability, et cetera.
Well, you'll be there on Saturday the 21st. Larry Mueller and I will be there on Friday, June 20th. We'll be doing garden talk there. Among our guests will be Mel Myers of Milwaukee. We're very happy that she will be able to join us, along with the Portage County Agriculture Agent as well. So we'll look forward to seeing folks at Custer, Wisconsin on June the 20th. And if you're there on Saturday, why, look around, because John Viner will be at the booth of, again, Focus on Energy. All right. Let's take some calls. If you'd like to join in, the number in Madison, 263-1890, or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Joan in Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I own a 96-year-old duplex, and I'm having the front porch totally rebuilt, and I have three basic questions. One is, what is the most durable wood you can suggest that will last for decades? The other is, how do I verify that I'm getting that wood? And the last would be, how do I make sure that the workers are fully covered with insurance in case of injury?
Well, Joan, those are some great questions. Let me start with the last one. The contractor you hire should be able to provide you with a certificate of insurance. And if they are, in fact, licensed with the state, and now in Wisconsin, we do have building contractor licensing as of the first of the year, 2008. So they should, they will, in fact, need to be licensed to obtain a permit to work on your duplex. So you should simply ask for those things, and you should receive them. As far as the materials being used, the most durable wood, I mean, that's a great question. I often ask myself that question. I imagine that this being an older duplex, it probably has some masonry pillars out front with a wood floor on it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I would recommend that all of the framing that is replaced or that is added to reinforce what is there be a treated lumber. That's essentially the wood that's not visible underneath the finished product. I would have to say that Douglas fir, tongue and groove flooring, porch flooring, still remains probably the best thing to use on a porch floor. There have been some products out there, some synthetic products, which we have used, which have caused a fair amount of grief for me as the contractor and for some of the homeowners that I've put in this material for. I am not feeling a strong degree of confidence if you're looking for a tongue and groove traditional floor surface. I would recommend Douglas fir as the product to use. And then as far as exterior trims, if you want to use a real wood product, I would say cedar is probably your best bet. If not cedar, there are some synthetic products out there with varying degrees of flexibility, warranties. Again, the contractor should be able to supply some information on the different products, you know, depending on whether it's going to be painted or stained. You know, there are a lot of choices and there are a lot of things to consider. How close is the floor to the ground on your porch?
Let's see. There's three cement steps leading up from the street, and then there's five wooden steps that have to be replaced to the porch.
Okay. So it's probably sitting about 3 feet above ground
that
level?
That sounds about right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's important that there be some ventilation in that crawl space. I mean, I'm going to assume, and let me just say this, generally, if the crawl space were above a heated surface, we would not recommend ventilating it. But if it's an outside porch and the area under there is enclosed, it's probably good that be ventilated so that the moisture doesn't build up in that space underneath your new remodeled porch. That's about the only other thing I would add.
Is there any living space up above that porch, or is it just an attic above?
It's a duplex.
I'm sorry, we didn't hear that answer. Go ahead again.
It's a duplex, so there's another porch on top of the bottom porch.
Okay. Upper and lower.
Right.
Okay. So no real insulating to be done there. Those porches aren't conditioned. I'm just looking at insulating and air sealing opportunities while we even sometimes those porch connections to the home can be a source of air leakage and opportunities to insulate. Any ice damming concerns around that area?
No, there was leakage before, but I got the flooring on the upper porch redone with rubber, so it doesn't leak anymore. So otherwise, everything is fine, except I want the wooden stuff replaced.
Okay.
And my question is, I mean, you know, how do I verify that I'm getting that Douglas fir and cedar trim? I mean, I don't know what it looks like.
Well, you know, there's always an element of trust that is going to play into any relationship with a remodeling contractor. And so I was going to add, I'm glad you asked again, that it's important that you check references. Any reputable contractor will have references that you can call. You should make sure that these aren't simply relatives or friends of the contractor, but in fact legitimate people that had no knowledge of this individual prior to hiring him or her, and that they were happy with the work that was done. You also can look for various professional affiliations, which will help add some credibility to the remodeling contractor. For example, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, a very reputable business association, which I happen to be a proud member of, and I actually serve on the national board in the interest of full disclosure. But the reason I'm proud to be a member of this particular association is that its focus is on customer education and ethics. And frankly, in the remodeling industry, we sorely need to educate the public on how important it is to make sure you're dealing with a reputable contractor and that you are getting what you are told you are getting, and that the businesses that are a member of the association live up to a standard of ethics, which we hold them to. So, and of course, the Better Business Bureau is another place that you might consider looking for contractors that have decided they want to also live up to their code of ethics.
You know, another quick way, if we want to identify if the wood is correct, I mean, you're going to have to educate yourself by heading down to that lumber store and picking up some pieces, holding it, feeling it, bringing a piece back. If you really want to get to know it, you've got to reach out and start holding that piece in your hand and looking at it real closely and bring it to the job site.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right, Joan. Good luck to you. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And on to Dave in Lake Tomahawk. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Great show.
Mm-hmm.
Quick question. My home is three years old. It's a poured, and I put 2-inch blue board in the outside insulation, and that sticks out of the ground about 2 feet. So it's kind of ugly looking. And I'm wondering if there's something I can put over that, or can I cut it off at ground level and paint the cement?
You definitely don't want to cut it off. That insulation at that critical juncture that connects the below-grade foundation to wherever the siding starts, really important to keep that well insulated and buffered from the winter winds and the summer heat. There are a couple of products out there. The most common product is one that I'll confess I don't like very much, but it's kind of a rolled vinyl product that can be applied over that foam board to help protect it. Something that I would recommend instead of that would be using a thin cement board product, like a Hardy Backer product that's going to give you a more durable and paintable surface that's going to protect that foam down at grade. You can actually just apply kind of a stucco paint to the cement or to the foam board. There are a couple of things that have to be done to prepare it for that. There's generally a thin film on it that you have to perforate. So that the stucco will properly apply to it. And sometimes you install a mesh over the foam before applying that product. But that's another way to go. That can be a little higher maintenance. But
I got a question, Chad. How does that, does the backer board, that cement board, how does that hold up as we put it in the soil? Is that, or do we got to keep that off the soil?
Well, that's a great question. It is not, on the one hand, it is not really designed like any siding. You don't generally want to bury it in the soil. But if you were going to take a product and allow it to have ground contact, I would say that cement siding is going to perform as well as a treated lumber, in my experience with it. And there are particular products which are designed for ground contact.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an excellent question.
A quick follow-up. I insulated the inside and also put about 1 inch of foam, sprayed foam. Is that the sill between the floor joists?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, I got about 1 inch of foam in there.
Okay.
If I would cut off that outside board, insulation board, and paint the block, would that work, or still not recommended?
I really wouldn't recommend it. What's above the insulation board? I mean, what's the siding on your home?
Above? It's a Durex. A Dura board, I mean.
Dura board, okay. And does that siding surface extend out beyond the foam blue board?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So you might consider just installing something similar to that down to cover that area below grade, or above grade rather, but below the siding framed portion of your house.
That's a good idea.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
You bet, Dave. Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Marcia next in Bessemer. Hi, Marcia.
Yes, I was curious. On the tankless hot water heater, do you have those in electric as well as gas? Because we don't have gas.
Certainly there are electric on-demand tankless water heaters, so that is an option. A nice supplement to any type of electric heat is solar. So solar is a great way to heat water and meet your water needs. So anytime somebody's heating water with electric, sure it'd be nice to complement that with a solar water heater. That's where payback looks really good when we use electricity as our fuel source for domestic hot water needs as well as space heating needs. So you can certainly go that route with electric tankless. At the same time, if we're going to invest in that, get that solar site assessment completed through Focus on Energy.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And on to John in Algoma. John.
Hi. I've been working on restoring and renovating a 100-year-old yellow brick farmhouse up in the countryside up here around Algoma. And energy problems are major with this old building. And over the last 10 years, we've done a lot of different things, basic things to improve it. However, it is about 3,200 square feet. We have hydronic heat, now propane, in the house. And I was wondering about solar hot water heating as an adjunct or add-on to this system, as well as possibly to the hydronic system. When the people put the propane furnace in, they recommended putting a heating system for the water that's actually part of the foam heating system. And I wondered if you could boost that with a solar system. And then I had a couple other questions, too, if you have time.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. If I understand that correctly, you have a boiler in the home now. How old is that boiler?
It's brand new.
Okay, so it's brand new. So some boiler systems can also do some of the domestic hot water needs as well. But certainly we can have a solar domestic hot water heating, preheat some of that water before it goes to that boiler. That can supplement that space heating needs. Often I'm seeing a lot of high-efficiency boilers. They're condensing boilers that are doubling as meeting space heating, domestic hot water needs. They're very low profile, take up small amount of space, and one boiler that's combined for both applications. And then when we supplement that with the solar hot water, boy, we got a top-of-the-line heating system that's best for hot water needs and for space heating.
John, we were having difficulty hearing you. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes, I am, but is this better?
All right. John?
I moved off of the...
Okay, go ahead.
...microphone. Is that a little bit clearer?
What's your follow-up question?
The follow-up question is about arched windows. This being an old yellow brick farmhouse, it has arched windows, and trying to find replacement windows, someone to manufacture replacement windows at a price that somebody could actually afford has proven to be a real challenge. We did do aluminum inserts on the second floor, so we didn't have to carry 40-pound storm windows up to the second floor. To put them on, they don't do much good, and I'm looking for someone who makes windows like that, and wondered if you might have any insight into that.
Well, generally, I'm a big fan of the Marvin window product, but I don't think anyone's ever accused Marvin of being particularly affordable. It is Consumer Reports rated top residential window for value and features. So I think you get the most window for the money, and Marvin is a completely customized plant up in Minnesota. So you might look at that. They do have a variety of levels of kind of their product line. So there are some more affordable things that they do, and then a higher-end product. Depending on the exact dimensions of your windows, that will depend, or that will determine whether or not you might be a candidate for a slightly lower cost window. Of course, there are some mill shops that are willing still to make things like that, but I mean, frankly, it's hard to do something custom like that and have it be done in a real cost-effective way. I mean, we've all grown accustomed to things being shipped cheaply from overseas, done, you know, produced very low cost by less affordable or rather, you know, lower cost labor. And those days are rapidly coming to an end, as perhaps they should. But it does cost a considerable amount of money to make a quality window. So I would say save your money and do it right when you do replace those units.
John, thank you very much for the call. Maybe time for one more caller. Let's go to Don in Brill.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I have an old house also that I've restored, and part of it is a large crawl space. It's, you've probably got 3.5 to 4 feet of room, but it's just a dirt underneath that. And the other part of the house is an old stone-laid basement, which, you know, is about 30-some inches thick. And I'd like to do something down there to... Spring and fall, mainly, we get, you know, if it gets humid, we get a musty smell in the house. And is there anything I can do down there to...
Sure. Some of the common steps that we would take is to certainly have a ground cover down over the dirt floor. And we want to, in the spring, as we, some of us get some musty smells in the basement as the first waves of warm weather and humidity come our way and we're opening the doors up and our basements and stone foundations are still really cold, we can get that condensation and get that musty odor. There are ways to keep that concrete, that stone foundation warm. A common application is a spray foam product. We want to first stop the humidity, the moisture that's being generated from the ground. That's a quality 6 mil plastic ground cover wrapped up those stone foundation walls, and then we use a nice insulating air with good air sealing properties, a closed cell foam up against that stone foundation wall, as long as we're not too worried about appearance. Now, a caution or a step that may be needed to be taken a look at when we use that spray foam is some fire protection. That code may require us to get a coating on there that has fire protection properties.
You put the plastic over the stone first? Or do you spray the foam on there?
I'll spray the foam on the stone as long as, again, we want to ensure that that doesn't get wet. So anytime we use that spray foam product or we start insulating in crawl spaces and basements, I better preface that with, darn it, we got to know that stays dry before we even go there. But if we know that, then the plastic is wrapped up the stone a foot or so just so that we can adhere the edges and create an airtight seal of that plastic to the foundation wall as we apply the spray foam.
Okay.
I'll just add the plastic is being used to keep the moisture from rising through the dirt. And then, it's going up onto the stone and really just being sealed by that foam. But the plastic's being used to seal the dirt.
Don, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. I'm sorry we can't get to all of the callers, but we've run out of time. Our guest on this program about home renovation and repair issues, John Viner of Building Services and Consultant in Mount Horb, Wisconsin. You can reach John at john@homeperformancetesting.net. And Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry of Madison. You can go to his website if you want to know more about what he does at chadscarpentry.com. And if you want to email him, it's chad@chadscarpentry.com. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll look forward to a return appearance in a couple of months.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Appreciate your being here today. As we talk about home renovation, tomorrow it's Garden Talk, and we'll have Madison Associate Professor and Turfgrass Expert John Steyer. He'll be here to talk about lawns and answer your questions here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.